Good evening. My name is Mary Black Juntinen. I'm the music librarian here at Michigan State. In case you haven't met me before, I usually hang out across the hall. And it is my pleasure to introduce to everyone our speaker for this evening, Marcy Ray. And for those of you who don't know her, a little bit of a biography here. She's an assistant professor of historical musicology here at Michigan State University. She was previously an opera singer, and she brings that performance background into her teaching and scholarship. She has presented her research at a wide array of conferences, including the American Society for 18th Century Studies, the Society for 17th Century Music, Feminist Theory and Music, and the American Musicological Society. Presently, she is working on a manuscript entitled The Politics of Love in French Baroque Opera, which studies changing representations of love, gender, and power on the early 18th century French stage. A version of the second chapter is forthcoming in a collection called The Libretto as Enlightenment Text. Tonight, she's giving a talk on Lerner and Lowe's musical My Fair Lady. This work will form a part of her second book on films that develop characters through voice lessons. As a singer myself, I find that really an interesting concept. So I hope you enjoy tonight's speech, and thank you for coming.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. Let's see if this works.
We've had numerous
technological issues. So how we're going to see the PowerPoint, is like this. Because for some reason, every time I turn it on, it decides to die. So this is better than nothing, I think. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming. This evening, I'll be talking about My Fair Lady, Alan J. Lerner and Friedrich Lowe's musical adaptation of George Bernard Shaw's early 20th century play, Pygmalion. The narrative framework is of much older vintage, dating back to the first century. It comes from Ovid's series of creation myths in his Metamorphoses. Here, the sculptor Pygmalion is so turned off by contemporary women that he decides to create his ideal woman out of ivory. Eventually, he falls in love with his statue, and when his desire softens his contempt for women, he prays successfully to Venus to have a woman just like his statue. The statue comes to life in his arms, and they are married. This tale has inspired a number of variations. Probably the best known to audiences today are films, including not only the 1964 film adaptation of My Fair Lady, but also Pretty Woman from 1990, She's All That from 1999, and most recently, Lars and the Real Girl from 2007. All feature a woman, except for the latter, which features a doll, that exemplifies an idealized femininity. This talk investigates how the plot and music of My Fair Lady constructs a normative femininity for audiences in 1964 America. I show in particular that music tries to stitch up moments where this idealization threatens to fall apart. I conclude by examining the casting decisions for the film adaptation, answering in particular why Audrey Hepburn was chosen to play the heroine, as opposed to Julie Andrews, who had created the role on Broadway. Critics now and then have complained that since Audrey Hepburn did not do most of her own singing in the film, the heroine's primarily lyrical power is undermined. In contrast, I will use the moments at which Hepburn's voice seems to fail to provide a new interpretation in which the dubbed singing voice reproduces emerging feminist discourse that juxtaposes culturally constructed ideals of femininity and a woman's critical inner voice. Although My Fair Lady remains set in early 20th century London in keeping with Shaw's play, like later adaptations of the Pygmalion myth, it nevertheless seeks to define current ideas about normative femininity. The plot revolves around the gruff and ill-mannered phoneticist, Henry Higgins, and the impoverished flower peddler, Eliza Doolittle. Eliza approaches Higgins for lessons to improve her English in hopes that she may transition from selling flowers on the street to the more lucrative and appealing task of selling flowers in a florist shop. In other words, she's hoping to raise her social standing by improving and refining her speech. Higgins had given her this idea one rainy night outside of Covent Garden, where he was transcribing her unruly Cockney accent as part of his study of phonetics. With the financial backing of Colonel Pickering, a gentleman linguist whom he met on the same rainy evening, Higgins agrees to an experiment. In 6 months' time, he will pass her off as a duchess at an embassy ball. And indeed, Eliza succeeds flawlessly. A rival phoneticist, rather than exposing her as a fraud, as they had expected, determines that Eliza is Hungarian royalty. He claims that she could not be a native speaker of English because her speech is too polished. My Fair Lady is more than just a tale about a socially ambitious woman. Since Ovid's day, versions of the Pygmalion myth have served to fashion and refashion what constitutes contemporary ideals of femininity. While Eliza's transformation into the model woman is exemplified in her speech, hers is really a total makeover. The early scenes of the film make clear that it is not just Eliza's speech that will need to be reformed for her to resemble an upper-class woman. She will need a full metamorphosis of body and mind. Though American audiences in 1964, when the film premiered, were not as invested in issues of class as were English audiences at the time of the play's London premiere in 1914, the film retains traces of class as a way to distinguish Eliza as the flower girl from what she is to become. A number of features, including music, lighting, and bodily comportment, distinguish the upper from the lower classes. These differences are staged from the very beginning. For example, the film opens with elegantly dressed men and women descending a grand staircase in Covent Garden, London's Royal Opera House. The music that accompanies this scene recalls music that's been used to characterize aristocratic characters in opera since the 18th century. It features a leisurely waltz with an emphasis on sweeping string melodies that have become emblematic of music to depict the upper classes. Like the waltz that accompanies them, the men and women glide through the opera house with elegant and restrained bearing. The setting and the way in which it is lit also play an important role in delineating class. First of all, Covent Garden is itself associated with upper class entertainment. According to the signs outside the theater, they've just finished attending Charles Gounod's Faust. But it's not just location that serves to demarcate class. The setting is richly lit, its effect heightened as it reflects off the white walls of the theater's interior hallways. This kind of bright lighting and general whiteness of the setting appear again in other upper-class venues in the film. The horse race scene at Ascot, here, so notice the whiteness, and as well the embassy ball, here. The first vibrant, fashionable scene in Covent Garden's interiors cuts quickly to the street. The music becomes frantic, in part because it's begun to rain. This music, however, becomes specifically tied to Eliza Doolittle, our heroine. Amidst the chaos of people trying to escape the rain, the camera begins to follow Eliza as she darts towards the protection of the church portico near the opera house. She puts her head down as she launches into the rain, and she runs headfirst into Freddie Eynsford Hill, a young aristocrat. Eliza tumbles to the ground, and the music stops. In other words, when Eliza's frantic movements stop, the music also ceases. The musical atmosphere of the street scene is markedly different from the elegant waltz associated with the aristocrats in Covent Garden. The music of the street sounds inspired by the musical language developed in the 18th century for comic, lower-class characters of opera. It features busy melodic motion in a brisk tempo, much like the patter style of comic operatic characters. The street scene is also delineated visually. In contrast to the illumination of the interior to Covent Garden, the street scene is dark. Eliza clearly belongs to the darkness of the street with her drab clothing and dirty face. And of course, it's heightened here because it's black and white. But you'll see this is Julie Andrews, and they've also made a point of darkening her face. These aspects, music, lighting, and venue, are calculated moves to show difference, but they simultaneously establish desire. It comes as no surprise that Eliza wants to be a part of the rarefied world exemplified by the chic crowd pouring out of Covent Garden. But the juxtaposition between the interior of the opera house and the street outside shows how far she must travel socially to get there. While there may be a racial subtext in the emphasis on whiteness in the film's upper-class venues, the bright illumination certainly constructs a sense of cleanliness and dirtiness. That this dichotomy is also borne out in several comments upon Eliza's unkempt appearance. For instance, at Covent Garden, Higgins points out her, quote, wretched clothes and dirty face, which we can see here. Later, when she calls upon Higgins at his home to inquire about lessons, Eliza is self-conscious about her dirtiness. When a chambermaid gawks at her, Eliza remarks, "London's getting so dirty these days," as she hurries to a mirror to clean the dirt off her face. Such distinctions between cleanliness and dirt have moral implications, as Mary Douglas has shown in her book, Purity and Danger. Douglas argues that the construction of pollution organizes society. These ideas inform what society accepts, as well as what it must destroy and finally banish beyond the pale. Mrs. Pierce, Mr. Higgins' housekeeper, confirms the moral implications of the cleanliness as she takes Eliza for her first bath. She cautions Eliza that you can't be a nice girl inside if you're dirty on the outside. From the beginning, Eliza is literally shown in a different light. But Eliza's voice serves as the primary site of difference. Indeed, it is the sound of her voice that compels Professor Higgins to begin transcribing her words. In the first scene, Eliza asks if Colonel Pickering would like to buy a flower. But instead of taking a flower, he simply offers her his loose change. But a bystander misunderstands this and sees Higgins taking down her speech and assumes he's a detective, and he tells Eliza this. Eliza, to defend herself from charges of theft, erupts into cries that she wasn't doing anything wrong. Here, and in several subsequent scenes, Eliza cries, shouts, and makes inarticulate sounds. Her volume increases, and the pitch of her voice ascends higher and higher. Furthermore, Hepburn, in her portrayal of Eliza, manipulates her voice so that cracks and breaks, generally sounding hoarse at times. In a later scene, when Mrs. Pierce takes Eliza for her first bath, Eliza again erupts into screams when she sees the steam rising from the tub. She refuses to get in or even undress. Mrs. Pierce and two chambermaids fight Eliza to get her clothes off. Throughout the whole ordeal, she screams and shouts. All of these sounds convey that she is poorly educated. Eliza's speech is both unruly in form and in content. In addition to her cries and shouts, she also explodes into vulgarities, most notably at Ascot, where she commands the horse on which she has a bet to move its bloomin' ass. Fellow characters describe Eliza's effusions as noise, which clearly has political connotations. Indeed, moving Eliza's communicative efforts from noise to speech is the main thrust of the play and its musical adaptation. It is a Foucauldian project of disciplining her speech into hegemonic norms that have long associated the feminine with excess and irrationality, and masculinity with language and logic. The verbal signs of emotional excess are complemented by physical effusions. First of all, Eliza's gestures are wild and unruly. In several scenes, Eliza throws her arms about and stamps her feet. Secondly, women have long been associated with bodily moisture, in part because of menstruation, but also because women have been constructed as emotionally volatile, prone to tears. My Fair Lady also participates in this centuries-old vision of femininity. On many occasions, Eliza's tears overflow and her nose runs. To emphasize that these displays are not part of the feminine ideal, Higgins is on hand to register his disgust. For instance, when Eliza first goes to Higgins' residence to ask him to give her lessons, she begins to cry when he claims that what she's offering to pay him would be equivalent to 60 or 70 pounds from a millionaire if calculated as a percentage of her income. Eliza misunderstands and thinks that he's asking her to pay this enormous sum. She cries and wipes her nose on her sleeve. Mrs. Pierce attempts to allay Eliza's fears, saying that no one's going to touch her money. But Higgins responds that no one is going to touch you with a broomstick if you don't stop sniveling. He hands her his handkerchief and tells her that it's to, quote, wipe your eyes, to wipe any part of your face that feels moist. All of these effusions, vocal and physical, will need to be restrained for her to become a proper lady. Three scenes can illuminate Eliza's subsequent metamorphosis in body and speech, from wild and unregulated to restrained and docile. In Act 1, Scene 5, Eliza's lessons have begun. Higgins commands Eliza to continue practicing her vowels, though she's clearly exhausted. So I'm going to show a clip of this, and what I'd like you to notice is that she's very wild in her gestures and her speech compared to Higgins.
Say your vowels.
I know my vowels. I know before I come.
But if you know them, say them.
I, A, I, O, U.
A, E, I, O, U.
That's what I said. I, E, R, O, U. That's what I've been saying for 3 days. I won't say them no more.
I know it's difficult, Miss Doolittle, but try to understand. There's no use explaining, Pickering. As a military man, you ought to know that. Drilling is what she needs. Now, you leave her alone, or she'll be turning to you for sympathy. Very well, if you insist, but have a little patience with her, Higgins. Of course.
Later in this scene, Eliza finally has a breakthrough. All night, she's been trying to enunciate clearly, the rain in Spain stays mainly on the plain, emulating Higgins's elocution. Here, she finally pronounces the phrase correctly, and her lyrical eloquence turns into song with the assistance of Marnie Nixon, whose voice was dubbed in for this number. At this moment, Eliza demonstrates her progress. Her speech is becoming well-formed, and her body movements less erratic. Her physical transformation is perhaps best seen in a set of stills from the film that can represent before and after shots. And it's not going to show me that. Okay. Well, the first one was on this side, and it's when she is singing Wouldn't It Be Lovely, and she's standing like this, and she's supposed to be representing a wealthy lady. She's acting as if she were a wealthy lady. And then when she's dressed as a wealthy lady and has learned to emulate one, she stands like this. And so it looks like, to me, that she's actually been turned into Pygmalion's statue rather than having come to life. Okay. But for scholars and lay audiences alike, Eliza's vocal and physical transformation wasn't enough to make a happy ending. Musicologist Raymond Knapp and literature scholar Charles Burst have both suggested that My Fair Lady conforms to a Cinderella paradigm, particularly because of the intimacy suggested in the Rain in Spain scene. I've never found this to be particularly satisfying. I would like to suggest a different reading, beginning with the very scene that for some initiated the Cinderella narrative. In the festive atmosphere of singing and dancing, which we'll see next, hopefully, or not. Yes, there we go. In this scene, what I'd like you to know, so he begins to dance with her as part of the celebration, but right when she succeeds, he actually pushes her out of the way to congratulate Pickering, which is something that happens over and over again. He doesn't congratulate her, the men congratulate themselves. So that's what I want you to notice.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
What was that?
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
Again.
The rain in Spain stays
so this is Audrey Hepburn.
The plain.
I think she's got it.
The
Marnie Nixon.
Spain stays mainly in the plain.
You can actually hear the echo of Audrey Hepburn there.
By George, she's got it. Now once again, where does it rain?
On the plain, on the plain.
And where's that soggy plain?
Hurricanes hardly happen. How kind of you to let me come.
Now once again, where does it rain?
On the plain, on the plain.
And where's that blasted plain?
In the rain.
Cinderella theme, however, was appealing because it could resolve two significant problems. First, not only was marriage a conventional way to end comedies, but it had long been thought to be an antidote to progressive women. Indeed, the idealized woman at this time was a married woman. For instance, in another contemporary musical, Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II, they solve a problem like Maria in The Sound of Music by marrying her off to Captain Von Trapp. To make this clear, the song A Problem Like Maria reprises during the wedding scene. Similarly, to have Eliza marry Higgins would provide quick closure to the question she asks after her success at the embassy ball. She asks, "What is to become of me?" Furthermore, it also forecloses the possibility that she will go on to teach phonetics, which she suggested before her final musical number, Without You. Secondly, a marriage plot could also resolve fears that Higgins is gay. Higgins' character threatens to become queer in a number of scenes. First of all, Higgins proclaims several times that he's a confirmed bachelor. Second, two of his musical numbers testify to his aversion to women. His music and language in these numbers serves to characterize his gender politics. When, for example, Higgins sings about himself and his sex in An Ordinary Man, his music is lyrical, at a leisurely tempo and dominated by the warm sounds of strings and woodwinds. But when he turns to the subject of women, the accompaniment becomes frantic, much more like the comic patter of lower class opera characters. It also features prominent brass interjections and percussion, a well-known tactic to signify difference. The quality and volume of Rex Harrison's voice also changes according to which sex Higgins is characterizing. Harrison talks through his description of men and practically shouts through the several lines in which he disparages women. Harrison raises his voice, for instance, to declare, "When you let a woman in your life, you're plunging in a knife," or to proclaim that he'd prefer another Spanish Inquisition to a woman's companionship. Higgins ends the song with the resolution that, "I shall never let a woman in my life." In a later musical number, his Hymn to Him, Higgins again rails against women. He declares that women are irrational. Their heads are full of cotton, hay, and rags. Overall, in both numbers, he characterizes women as emotionally volatile, selfish, irrational, and irritating. But it's not just Higgins' songs that suggest he's gay. There is also no indication of any emotional or physical intimacy between Higgins and Eliza. Throughout the musical, Higgins fails to display much feeling for his pupil. For instance, right before they leave for the embassy ball, Pickering asks, "What about the girl? You act as though she doesn't matter at all." Higgins responds that nothing could matter more than transforming a human being by creating a new speech for her. While he expresses noble sentiments, they are too general to serve as an intimate expression of his feelings for Eliza. Furthermore, following Eliza's triumph at the ball, Higgins again fails to show much sentimental attachment to her. Now that the experiment is over, Eliza is worried about what she's going to do next. Higgins suggests that she marry. He explains that not all men are confirmed bachelors like he and the colonel. He points out that, quote, "most men are the marrying sort. Poor devils," he sighs under his breath. Higgins goes on to convey that her prospects for marriage are good since she's, quote, "not bad looking." But after he proclaims that she's really quite a pleasure to look at sometimes, he then insults her. "Not now that you've been crying, you look like the very devil." At these moments, especially when Eliza is so vulnerable, Higgins seems incapable of loving anyone other than himself. Eliza also notes the lack of physical intimacy between them. When she decides to leave Higgins, she runs into Freddie, the young aristocrat from the opening scene, who shows genuine love for her. He has been sending her several letters a day to declare his love for her. In this scene, as he begins to wax poetic, Eliza interrupts him with her song, "Show Me." She tells him that she doesn't want to hear any more words. "Words, words, words, I'm so sick of words. I get words all day long, first from him, now from you. Is that all you blighters can do? Don't talk of stars burning in love. If you're in love, show me," she sings. Eliza later clarifies how she understands her relationship to Higgins. She tells Higgins that Freddie writes her twice or three times every day, to which Higgins responds, "Oh, in short, you want me to be as infatuated about you as he is that it?" "No," she says, "that's not the sort of feeling I want from you." Although she admits that she's come to care for him, it is a friendly, not romantic relationship that they've built. Despite the fact that Higgins and Eliza never share romantic moments, the music attempts to construct intimacy between them. For instance, after the rain in Spain scene, Eliza responds enthusiastically not to her progress, but to the fact that Higgins danced with her. She sings dreamily, "I'll never know what made it so exciting, but all at once my heart took flight. I only know when he began to dance with me, I could have danced all night." This tune returns to punctuate certain important moments. For instance, when Eliza, Pickering, and Higgins embark for the embassy ball, Eliza stands at the bottom of the stairs looking anxious until Higgins offers his arm to her. "I could have danced all night," then swells in the orchestra. This song appears again at the very end of the film. Rather than concluding with a more conventional loving embrace, Eliza and Higgins don't even touch in the final moments of the film, which undermines the idea that this is a Cinderella story. Higgins reclines back in his chair, puts his hat over his eyes, and asks Eliza, "Where the devil are my slippers?" Eliza approaches, but not close enough to touch him, as "I could have danced all night" again blossoms in the accompaniment. Overall, the accompanying music attempts to fill in gaps between Higgins and Eliza's intimacy, stirring up a romantic spark that never ignites in their interactions. This awkward ending is a failure both of the Pygmalion tale and of the Cinderella narrative. To make sense of My Fair Lady's many deviations from Ovid's tale, I argue that My Fair Lady is just as much an adaptation of Pygmalion as it is of another closely related tale from the Metamorphoses, that of Echo and Narcissus. My Fair Lady's emphasis on vocality, for instance, is the first departure from the original Pygmalion myth. In the Metamorphoses, Ovid gave the statue no vocal presence at all. She is known only through the voice of her sculptor. Both Shaw's play and its later musical adaptations nevertheless show Eliza's metamorphosis predominantly through her voice. But it's not just the emphasis on voice that makes My Fair Lady a version of Echo and Narcissus, which is explicitly about voice. Higgins' character also seems to be modeled in several places upon Narcissus. In Ovid's story, see if we can get a picture to come up. Yeah. Juno, the goddess of marriage, has punished Echo for detaining her with idle chatter while her notoriously unfaithful husband, Jupiter, was seducing a mountain nymph. Juno destines Echo to repeat only the last sounds of other people's utterances. Henceforth, she is incapable of speaking words of her own. To demonstrate the tragedy of the situation, Ovid relates Echo's failed attempt to woo Narcissus. One day, Echo spies Narcissus roaming the countryside. She instantly falls in love with him and pursues him through the woods. But filled only with love for himself, which you can see here as he gazes at his own reflection, he rejects her. Consumed by grief, Echo flees into the forest where her body shrinks away. Eventually, only her voice remains. Echo's continuing existence can only be known through her voice, which can only communicate through the words of someone else. I think it's fairly easy to see how Eliza and Higgins share similarities to Echo and Narcissus. Eliza, for instance, spends much of her time repeating what Higgins says to learn how to speak properly. She also experiences several moments of unreturned affection. After her triumph at the embassy ball, for example, she waits in vain for congratulations as Higgins and Pickering pat themselves on the back. Likewise, Higgins seems modeled on Narcissus. Most blatantly, at the end of Why Can't a Woman, he asks rhetorically, "Why can't a woman be more like me?" Furthermore, the fact that on a number of occasions he acts like a petulant child, one could easily argue that Higgins, like Narcissus, is locked into what psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan would call the mirror stage. Lacan claimed that in this stage, where an infant identifies with his own image in a mirror, he may feel both elated as he recognizes himself, while also feeling alienated from his mother. He may thus long for a return to wholeness, represented by his former identification to his mother. Higgins similarly longs to be reconnected to the comforting presence of his mother, because like after Without You, after she sings this big number saying that she doesn't need him anymore, he just, "Mother, mother!" And it's something that she actually refuses over and over again. She looks at him like he's a bore. So with this proliferation of popular psychology in the 1950s and 1960s, Higgins seems to have an unnatural attachment to his mother, which would have evoked Freud's theory that gay men often have an intense attachment to their mothers. In addition, Rex Harrison's own reaction to Eliza's triumphant song Without You is a stunning display of how My Fair Lady is an adaptation of Echo and Narcissus. Harrison himself was troubled by the lyrical power of Without You, and in the last few days before the Broadway show opened in 1956 with Julie Andrews as Eliza, Harrison says something that I actually don't feel comfortable repeating in front of you. This is a polite audience, and it's something that I've actually never said personally, but it is awful. It is a horrible vulgarity. He would not let Julie Andrews just sing at him. So, to appease him, Lerner and Lowe wrote Higgins' interjections into this song, where he attempts to reduce Eliza to an echo of Higgins. Only with these additions did Harrison agree to perform in the scene. Thus, Harrison's own narcissism could not endure Andrews' powerful vocality. And indeed, the power of the singing voice works against the idea that this is based on Pygmalion, since Harrison's Higgins, voiced by a non-singing actor who could only talk through his vocal numbers, can hardly claim to have created Andrews' powerful and lyrical Eliza. Despite the similarities to the tale of Echo and Narcissus, My Fair Lady departs from this story as well. Unlike Echo, Eliza's voice becomes a metaphor for her growing power rather than the last remnant of her shadowy existence. Eliza's vocal transformation and emerging agency is best heard in her final number, Without You, when she's fed up with Higgins. Here she confronts him, enraged, but she finally knows her own worth. As she sings this song, you'll see Higgins make some interruptions, but then he finally shuts down the whole song altogether.
That's done you, Henry Higgins, it has. Now I don't care that for your bullying and your big talk. What a fool I was, what a dominated fool, to think you were the earth and sky. What a fool I was, what an irritated fool, what a button-headed dolt was I. Now, my reverberating friend, you are not the beginning and the end. You impudent hussy. Such an idea in your head or a word in your mouth that I haven't put there. There'll be spring every year without you. England still will be here without you. There'll be fruit on the tree and a shore by the sea. There'll be crumpets and tea without you. Art and music will thrive without you. Somehow Keats will survive without you. And there still will be rain on that plain down in Spain. Even that will remain without you. I can do without you. You, dear friend, who talk so well. You can go to Hartford, Hereford, and Hampshire. They can still rule. Without your falling it, the tide comes in. Without your twirling it, the earth can spin. Without your pushing them, the clouds roar more. If they can do without you, ducky, how can I? I shall not feel alone without you. I can stand on my own without you. So go back in your shell.
Eliza, you're magnificent. 5 minutes ago, you were a millstone round my neck, and now you're a tower of strength, a consort battleship. I like you this way.
Goodbye, Professor Higgins. You shall not be seeing me again.
D- Despite the potential feminist implications of Eliza's declaration of independence in this scene, her transformation is diffused at the conclusion of the film, when the lights fade out upon Higgins and Eliza to the strains of "I Could Have Danced All Night." The audience is left to imagine the beginning of a romantic relationship. The desire to have Eliza end up with Higgins was too powerful for Lerner and Lowe to resist, even though Shaw elaborately ruled it out in the postscript to his play. The film's ending attempts to reverse the tragic conclusion of the Echo and Narcissus myth, in which only Echo's voice remains and Narcissus's body wastes away from unrequited love for himself. He eventually transforms into a white flower. While Eliza's return to Higgins suggests that she will assume a submissive role no more powerful than Echo, an abject position that obliterates the message of "without you," I would like to address a number of choices made for the film adaptation that may offer a hermeneutic window for feminist reading. Specifically, I will address casting choices and the role that dubbing plays in the film. When the musical was adapted for the film in 1964, voice became the central issue of controversy. Fans of the successful Broadway musical were distressed that Julie Andrews had not been selected to play Eliza in the film alongside original members of the cast, namely Rex Harrison. Audiences were very familiar with Andrews in this role, not only because the musical had a record-breaking six-year run on Broadway, but the original cast recording had become a staple in people's homes, selling over 5 million copies before the film opened. A reporter for the New York Times claimed that Andrews' absence was one of the most talked about aspects of the film prior to its premiere. Instead, Audrey Hepburn was chosen to portray Eliza Doolittle. Her attempts to do her own singing, however, were deemed inadequate. American soprano Marnie Nixon provided the voice for many of her musical numbers. Critics then and now have disparaged this arrangement. Critic Russell Baker went further than most, claiming that neither Hepburn nor Nixon should be applauded for their portrayal of Eliza. Apparently, without irony, he claims that, quote, "the invisible men making the dubbing possible are the real heroes of the film. It makes no sense," he writes, "to sit through a musical cheering a leading lady who is not singing and a singer who is invisible." Even now, musicological criticism continues to lament Andrews' absence from the film. Raymond Knapp, for example, explains that the relationship between Higgins and Eliza is defined by vocality. He claims that the genius of Lerner and Lowe's stage version of My Fair Lady is that it paired a non-singing actor, Rex Harrison, with singer Julie Andrews. Indeed, Lerner's wife gives credence to this idea. Nancy Olson revealed that Lerner did not feel that Higgins' character was emotionally capable of singing outright. Instead, Shaw's emotionless character had to be played by an actor, not a singer, to give the sense that Higgins was expressing himself intellectually, but not emotionally. Thus, as Knapp argues, the relationship between Higgins and Eliza is defined by mutual desire. While Eliza longs to speak well, Higgins may equally long for the emotional capacity to lift his voice in song. Ultimately, Knapp concludes that dropping Andrews from the film was, quote, "unforgivable," since by dubbing in Marnie Nixon's singing voice, quote, "the entire point of Eliza's lyrical vocality is lost." Rather than considering Marnie Nixon's dubbed-over voice a liability to the musical of My Fair Lady, I'd like to use it as an opportunity for a new interpretation. I argue that the powerful, even feminist voice is still lurking in the film adaptation at precisely the moments when Hepburn's voice seems to fail. To do this, we must understand the context for the film adaptation. According to literary scholar Theodore Zilkowski, Ovid's The Metamorphoses reappears at different moments to herald times of change. Its stories of mutable bodies are apt metaphors for social revolutions. It should come as no surprise, then, that a number of tales from The Metamorphoses reemerged in 1960s America. Indeed, it was a period of significant social transformations. As Gail Collins put it in her recent book, it was, quote, "when everything changed." While there were a number of important social shifts at this time, the emergence of second-wave feminism is particularly relevant to this reading. In the midst of sweeping changes in political rights, including John F. Kennedy's creation of the Commission on the Status of Women, feminists also invited women to contemplate the shape of their intimate lives. One of the most famous texts to emerge from 1960s feminist discourse is Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, which was published in hardback in 1963 and released in paperback in 1964. Friedan's text largely catalogs the growing dissatisfaction among upper-middle-class housewives who longed for something more than their roles as childcare providers, meal makers, and house cleaners. She noted that women's impatience with these roles often gained consciousness through what she described as a transgressive inner voice. She highlights the tension between a culturally constructed identity found upon what she called the feminine mystique and the inner voice that urges a woman to defy social expectations. And here are just a few examples from her text. It is frightening when a woman finally realizes that there is no answer to the question, who am I, except the voice inside of herself. When society asks so little of women, every woman has to listen to her own inner voice to find her identity in this changing world. And finally, the very last line of the feminine mystique. But the time is at hand when the voices of the feminine mystique can no longer drown out the inner voice that is driving women on to become complete. And here are a few more. In this context, I would like to understand the two voices in My Fair Lady. That is, the dubbing technology used in the film granted Hepburn's Eliza an inner voice. While some might argue that this voice turns Hepburn into Echo, it, unlike Eliza's speaking voice, does not simply echo Higgins, but it is lyrically much more powerful. Indeed, Marnie Nixon's voice, unlike Hepburn's docile body at the end, is unreachable and resistant. Neither can Higgins reproduce it himself, nor does he capture it on his gramophone to turn on and off as he likes. Ultimately, this singing voice, far from Higgins's grasp, keeps Eliza from being a mere reproduction of Higgins. All of this stems from a compromise as opposed to authorial intention in which Hepburn was not allowed to perform Eliza's songs on her own. But since many audience members were aware of this compromise through newspaper articles addressing these issues, they may have been less likely to take Eliza's singing voice at face value, and in turn may have actively listened for differences between Hepburn's and Nixon's voices. Although Nixon's American accent is at times patently clear, strangely enough, it's much easier to see that Eliza's voice and body are not aligned. Unlike Harrison, who was recorded as he talked his way through his songs, Hepburn lip-synced to pre-recorded songs, and the timing isn't quite right. The gap between Hepburn's miming and Nixon's singing invites hermeneutic interpretation. Unlike Echo, who is destined to repeat the words of others, Eliza uses the voice of another to enhance her quest for self-expression. To conclude, I suggest that we understand the importance of these choices through Raymond Williams' definition of hegemony. He says that while the hegemonic culture is dominant, its power is not static or total. Dominant ideals are in a perpetual state of defense and renewal as it grapples with internal counter-hegemonic forces. The active presence of the counter-hegemony has significant effects on the development of dominant culture. Counter-hegemonic culture may take two forms, he writes, the residual and the emergent. Experiences, meanings, and values from the past that have been incorporated into dominant culture constitute the residual. For instance, in My Fair Lady, the class distinctions from early 20th century England could be called residual. These class distinctions, while not so meaningful to an American audience in 1960s, nevertheless served to mark Eliza as other, marginalized from the dominant culture. New meanings and values, on the other hand, constitute the emergent. In My Fair Lady, as well as many other musicals from this period, the emergent is found in the feminist presence that threatens to collapse the reigning order. Julie Andrews and her musical roles on Broadway and on film, for instance, represent the emergent. Throughout her career, she sang alongside non-singing actors, so My Fair Lady, but also notoriously Camelot, and she effectively emasculates them with the power of her voice. For the dominant order to maintain its power, it must acknowledge and diffuse the threat of the emerging force, but in doing so, the dominant culture must transform as well. The tension in My Fair Lady between the emergent and the dominant began with the Broadway musical. Julie Andrews' powerful vocality was a symbol for women's public voices generally. It was the emergent voice that the film adaptation attempts to control in its dominant image of ideal femininity. Instead of casting Julie Andrews alongside the other members of the original Broadway cast, they select Audrey Hepburn. She could better represent a hegemonic vision of femininity, both in voice and body. Since, for instance, Hepburn did not do much of her own singing, she couldn't be claimed to have overpowered Harrison. Furthermore, Hepburn's very fragile slight frame is more docile than Andrew's more robust figure and commanding presence. The film seems then to have incorporated and diffused what Andrew's Eliza threatened to blow apart. But maybe not. While the casting choices seemed to represent a step back for vocal women, it was at this moment that they, with the help of feminist discourse, such as the feminine mystique, began to perceive differences between a culturally constructed femininity and their critical inner voice. It is this distinction that is replicated in the film adaptation of My Fair Lady. While Hepburn may have been more ideal to play normative femininity, the disjuncture between her body and musical voice is the space in which women would ultimately drive a wedge to move towards a more lasting metamorphosis for women. As Jacques Attali acknowledges in his book Noise, The Political Economy of Music, music's mode of production can signal new social formations. As a result, My Fair Lady heralds the voice of change. Thank you. Thank you. I will entertain questions or comments. Yes.
Is it possible that Audrey Hepburn was chosen because the producers thought she would be a bigger draw at the box office? Do you think that entered some of their thinking?
Yes, absolutely. And that's the claim that they made, is that she would draw more audiences because she was already an established figure, whereas Julie Andrews was not yet at this point on film. She did, however, win the Oscar this year for The Sound of Music, while Rex Harrison won for Best Actor. And so you can actually see this moment at the Oscars on YouTube. And when he goes up there, Audrey Hepburn presents him with the Oscar. And the whole time, is it going to be Rex Harrison? Is it going to be somewhere else? They keep panning to Julie Andrews, who was clearly it's upsetting. She wasn't chosen for the film, so how is she going to react, you know? So they knew, but she actually won that year. So when she went up to accept her Oscar, she thanked the producers, Jack Wagner, I think, for not selecting her so that she could go on and win the Oscar, for Sound of Music. So it was kind of catty, but awesome. Other questions, comments? Okay, I guess that's it then. Thank you.